You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Up next, the second in our five-part series from Radio Netherlands on the War of Words. Today's segment, The Cutting Room, produced and presented by Michelle Ernstein.
And we, the democracies of this world,
we will use whatever means are necessary to achieve our objective.
The cutting room floor is where a lot of information ends up during war and peacetime, often not due to censorship, but rather a complex form of self-censorship by corporate-run media. So just what is being cut out or added in, and why? This program focuses on the American media, but could apply to corporate media in any country. Today on the cutting room floor, from Geneva, Johan Galtung, the founder of Peace Studies. From Amsterdam, Sees Hamelink, professor of international communications. From London, Alan Davis, of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. From San Francisco, journalist and author Mark Hertzgaard. And from New York, Steve Rendall, senior analyst for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
I mean, you have some very extraordinary relationships in U.S. media. You have NBC. One of the major television networks is owned by GE, one of the biggest defense contractors in the world. You know, they make not only make nuclear power plants, but they make a whole array of high-tech weaponry. They were, at one point, the biggest military manufacturing company in the world. Now they own a television network. 30 years ago, this couldn't have happened. We had antitrust laws in place that would have kept that from happening. Apparently, the journalistic ethics of NBC don't encompass the fact that they should not be owned by a defense contractor either. You know, a major, the biggest budget item in the United States. And the press lives off corporate money. It lives off corporate advertising. Even if you discount the fact that these news agencies are owned by giant corporations who have all of the interests of giant corporations, their bread and butter is a daily infusion of corporate advertising dollars, of money for advertising from other giant corporations. And so what you have is the corporate interest infuses the government, infuses the media. You know, there's all sorts of political fights about these things, not even to mention the fact that they benefit and profit substantially from war when wars happen. But we have all sorts of relationships like this throughout the American press. So if you want to hear dissenting voices, if you wanted to hear people, critical voices about the U.S. response, about what George Bush said, that we were attacked on September 11th because we're a shining beacon of democracy and freedom, don't look to the mainstream American press to tell you, gee, if we're such a shining beacon of democracy and freedom, how come all of our allies in the Middle East are corrupt and anti-democratic?
Those bases, built up with Saudi money and American contractors, would make the best strategic launch pad against Iraq. Turkey, theoretically, would be the next best base. And Jurluk has been used for flights.
The American press is owned by the biggest transnational corporations in the world, and they are not in the habit of hiring people who are going to hurt their bottom line.
Author Mark Hertzgaard.
Now, that doesn't mean that we journalists are told on a daily basis, don't do this story, don't do that story, do this instead. It's a subtler process than that. News, you know, is very fast. It's a breaking thing. You cannot possibly intervene if you're the corporate superior every day. You don't have time. Instead, what happens is you hire the people in those jobs who will make the decisions that you like. And you get rid of the people if they make decisions that you don't like. Now, I had personal experience with this a number of times. I was once fired from a national public radio because I did a little satire that poked fun at McDonald's and NBC television. And my boss told me, you were criticizing the free enterprise system, and you can't do that. It was that direct. Now, usually, the censorship is not expressed that directly because most reporters don't have to be told. Most reporters don't go over that line. I'm an outsider. I'm a freelancer. I'm not on staff at these places. and I'm not going to make that deal. I'm not going to censor myself. You know, journalists get messages every day from their superiors according to, well, what story got printed and what story didn't? What assignments do I get and what assignments do they not give me? What story ideas get accepted for pursuit and what story ideas are rejected? Who gets promoted? Who doesn't get promoted? It's like any job. You see what your superiors want and you either give it to them if you want to advance or you don't and you leave. So in that sense, it's not much different than other jobs. It's just that the effect of it is very important to our democracy, and it ends up leaving our democracy impoverished because we do not hear in any meaningful way criticisms of the basic power relations in American society, whether it be corporate or the political elite.
How influential are journalists in conflict situations?
Alan Davis of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
We did a study on that, not in Afghanistan because it's too recent, but our study looked at Cambodia, Georgia in the Caucasus, Bosnia and South Africa, and basically concluded that the media has been a power for evil in actually encouraging the conditions for conflict.
I think this is typical when you live in the middle of an empire and you're looking at their media, so you're going to see a lot of stuff that just really echoes. We talk about having three branches of government. We have the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Then we also refer to the press as the fourth estate. So what we say here often is that the press is often a fourth branch of government, that it just echoes official agendas, and occasionally a dissenting voice will get in, rarely during wartime, but occasionally a dissenting voice will get in, but it's really very rare for that to happen. So what we've seen the media do is sort of carry forth the official U.S. agenda, the White House agenda on the war against terrorism. During any military buildup in the United States, what you see is even a narrower debate. And what we've seen is a virtual rumble line of militarists, all of the networks hire ex-generals, ex-Pentagon employees. Do they go out to universities and find people who've spent decades studying peace, studying international diplomacy, studying international law and human rights? No, they don't.
And from our studio in London, we have Ron Willis, an expert on international security.
Our expert at the Pentagon is standing by.
Carl Mills is the head of a think tank which advises the government on defense issues.
Our newspapers, our media, emerged in a period in world history when the nation-state was very strong. And the nation-state was growing and the media were growing. I'm talking about, if you will, the 19th century, to some extent before that, and certainly also the 20th century, the century behind us.
Peace activist Johan Galtung.
I think you can find in almost all countries that there is one or two newspapers and one or two channels and one or two radio stations that the government thinks they can rely upon. Like there is one or two universities. And they don't care so much about the others as long as these people can be defined as, quote, experts, unquote, being the ones that people will listen to. Now, the word expert has an aura of authorization about it. I'm always extremely skeptical when I hear an expert, because I know that I'll get something dishonest. Not in the sense that he's lying, but in the sense that he's leaving out things. And that is usually what the governments would like him to do.
To say that the media was following some popular patriotic upsurge would be putting the cart before the horse. The media is at the forefront of leading and trying to engender that popular upsurge of patriotism, as they would call it. Patriotism is a huge word here, and it only has one meaning in the sort of mass media understanding of it, and that is that you support the United States, right or wrong. And of course, in their view, it's always right these days.
Maria Rose Abad.
Michael Essiak.
Thomas J. Ashton.
Janice Marie Ashley.
The names of all of the 2,801 people who died in the World Trade Center were read out on the anniversary of September 11th. The American media put a human face on each one of the victims. The full weight of the tragedy emerged with their identification as mothers, fathers, children,
neighbors. But Afghanistan is also a country of mothers, fathers, children, and neighbors. How many of them have been shot, or blown up, or starved? And why don't we know?
The thing that strikes us most about the bombing in Afghanistan is the lack of reporting on civilian casualties. There's been virtually zero reporting on civilian casualties here in the United States. And that is because reporters here are taking their leads from the Pentagon and from the White House. The Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who's the chief of the Pentagon, came out and said that there was no way they could provide numbers on civilian casualties to reporters because, after all, the fog of war, it's too hard, there's too much confusion there, and you can't tell. Well, other groups are able to get these numbers, and if the Pentagon can't, well, it's not believable that they can't. However, the U.S. press has taken the Pentagon at its word and sort of, you know, not taken any real interest.
There has been an attack from the air on a leadership compound southeast of Kandahar. Whoever was there is going to wish they weren't, but in terms of their names, I don't have them.
When there's a major superpower fighting a war, it's harder to actually check the veracity of what's happened rather than easier. Let's look at Afghanistan in the last sort of 6, 7, 8 months. There's been a little debate, but not much, surprisingly not much at all, about the level of Afghan casualties. Given this is a war, you actually think that that should be the first question on everybody's mind every day. How many people have been killed in this war? How many people have been injured? And if you actually just paid attention to the Pentagon press briefings, you'd get the view that, well, there's been no casualties at all, or maybe there's been a couple of hundred here and there, what have you. But some people, I think an American academic who's done some research into this, said it could be up to sort of, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 people. And then when he or somebody else comes up with these kind of figures, a lot of people say, well, you know, where do you get these figures from? That's nonsense. But in which case, if it's nonsense, who, if not this person, is actually collating these figures?
It's really quite an extraordinary point of view about war that the United States has come to have. I guess since Grenada, Panama in 1989, the Gulf War in 1991, and Kosovo, and now this, I guess the United States is becoming accustomed to having these clean little wars that they mainly fight from a distance. I mean, one of the jokes that we tell around here is the U.S. infantry is generally further back from the action in these wars than the U.S. press is, and that's pretty far away.
I went through all the clippings that were reported in World Press Review, which is a monthly magazine, on September 11 and its aftermath, and a couple of other sources, so let us say about 1,000 reports. And, of course, it is very clear that the diagnosis, the analysis, is different depending on where you are. So if it is from the West, it was an attack by evil forces against democracy, civilization, our cultural values. And that was the main approach taken. There were some dissident voices pointing out that maybe it also had to do with something in Western politics. But there were not very many. If you then go to the Islamic world, and especially to the Arab countries, you will find shock and rejection of the approach, but at the same time that it is understandable given Western and particularly United States foreign policy. So you can say in a sense that the diagnosis is very easily predicted, although it was not to be expected that the Western press, with the so-called openness of Western societies, where mainstream press is concerned, was so unanimous in imitating the U.S. presidency. There was one uniform thing that went through, practically speaking, all the 1,000, not a single proposal. Absolutely nothing. Zero nil, which is amazing. Here you have a major thing going on, and the media are operating in such a way that they do not produce suggestions, proposals. I find that shocking.
The American media is not, by nature, an adversarial media. It tends to reflect the views of the political class, especially the Washington Press Corps. And, you know, those reporters will tell you, our job is not to be pro or con on the president. Our job is to report what he does and to be what they call objective. And in the name of political neutrality, reporters in Washington tend to believe that what they need to do is essentially report what the big players are saying. So I call the Washington Press Corps a palace court press because they are just like the palace court courtiers of, you know, the Middle Ages. They're very good at saying what the king wants to do and who's influencing the king, president that is, to push this way, that the Cheney and the Rumsfeld faction want to invade Iraq, but the Powell and Condoleezza Rice faction are nervous. They're quite good at that. And they're very good at saying what the reaction on Capitol Hill is, all the intrigues of palace politics. But they never stand back from that and give a truly critical view or offer alternative analyses.
Mr. President, what would be your next step in this operation?
Just one question.
If I could sum up Fair's problem with the U.S. press, it would be this. We see one of the main tasks of journalism as monitoring power, going to those in charge and holding their feet to the fire, making sure that you ask tough questions, you scrutinize power wherever it is and however it's acting, and whatever your own personal politics are as a journalist, you have to monitor and ask tough questions of power. This just isn't done here. And it's never done. It doesn't matter if it's Democrat or Republican, the tough questions, if you ask tough questions in a Pentagon briefing room, you will soon find that your access to that briefing room becomes very difficult.
Kristen hasn't held a news conference since last July. He's held two this year. Isn't that a long time? I mean, with all due respect to you, Ari, you're a very good spokesman, I suppose, for the White House.
But, I mean, keep going, Helen.
Really would like to question the president on all the statements he's made, and it can only come from him.
Helen, your views on this are well known, and you've articulated them. No, I understand the press's views on this. Let me take that. The president continues to take a great many questions from reporters in numerous different forums, and I understand that you would like him to take questions in the form of a news conference. I assure you we take a look at this often and
say no.
Where? And say no.
And you will often, when you ask tough questions, see the other journalists, the other better-behaved journalist in the room, look at you like you're some sort of a freak.
In the context of September 11th, if you're seen to be asking too many questions, you're then, as George Bush would say, if you're not for us, you're against us. If you're not for invasion of Iraq and the deposition of Saddam Hussein, well, you're against it, and you support him. I mean, you know, that the two are not synonymous there, and that's the problem. So I think it's a big problem in America where people in the media are starting to be very nervous about asking questions. I mean, it now seems the FBI are actually going into libraries in America and actually asking for records of what people have been reading or whatever. Crazy things that happen in America now. And so if a journalist is actually trying to say, well, sorry, Mr. George Bush, where's your proof that we've got chemical weapons plants in Baghdad or whatever, why can't we let the UN inspectors get on with their job? Let's send in more UN inspectors. Let's actually have more congressional visits to Baghdad. Let's actually, you know, get some dialogue going here. Anybody actually starts to say that will be automatically within the media booed, you know, you're not on the side, you're not on the team, get on the team. So the climate for actually asking probing questions is not right, and that's a worrying thing. There's a sort of a, in the context of September 11th, it's basically, you know, good versus bad, evil versus good.
Bearing in mind that there's many journalists of good faith working at these mainstream media outlets who are trying to do a good job under very difficult conditions, the tone of the American press has been shameless jingoism, cheerleading, with very little else. We had a whole debate here about should the television networks regularly fly the American flag logo on their screens down in the corner while they're reporting on the news being generated out of the quote-unquote terror war. This is completely unprofessional. Displaying the actual colors, you know, flying the colors of one of the subjects of your story, it's gotten that bad. Many of them don't even realize what a severe undermining of their professional standards that represents. The media, too often, is simply a public relations arm of U.S. official agendas, of the Bush White House, Pentagon, State Department, what have you. So what's happened is, and the same thing happens every time we get in a war. I mean, George Bush's father had a 91% approval rating in the middle of the Gulf War. When the war was over, a few months later, he lost sort of ignominiously in a presidential election. The consolation for those who are a little bit afraid when any government leader has a 90% plus approval rating, the consolation is that this approval is very shallow. It's not based on any sort of deep respect that Americans have for George W. Bush. It's because it's all generated by media. Because one story is about, gee, what a take charge guy. We thought he was a dunce. We thought he was an idiot before, but now that there's a war, we find out that he's really grown into the job. He's really a wonderful leader. And now we're going to do a story about Tom Cruise. And that's how it works. So it's all very fleeting and mercurial.
And turning from world news to today's top celebrity story, shoppers in New York were surprised to see the star of the primetime television series Top of the World lining up at their local video store.
This is the problem that we're now facing. There's a blurring of news already with entertainment and information. News used to be news, used to be news. Now, as we see in America, CNN is owned now, I think, by Time Warner, which also makes, you know, movies. We used to say good things, we used to say bad things about CNN, but in terms of the Afghan coverage, I think the winner in terms of the media market in America was Fox News. And Fox News dressed up their coverage to be much more entertainment than actually news. There was the famous case of the news anchor actually going to Afghanistan, packing a pistol and actually taking aim at so-called Al-Qaeda and firing it. And this was actually shown on primetime American TV.
Television news is almost totally useless. I mean, if you take one of the major news broadcasts, each of the three major networks in the United States put on a half-hour news broadcast each early evening, about 6:30 here in New York, and of the half-hour, 9 or 10 minutes of that is taken up with advertisements. So you have 20 minutes to cover the world. Now, some of that 20 minutes is also taken up with celebrity fluff and gossip and stories that tout other programming on their network. So in the end, you get almost nothing.
The problem is in 3 minutes, you can't afford, or you're not allowed by your news editor to give the context. If you talk about yesterday, somebody will say, well, that's yesterday. What happened now? What's going to happen tonight or tomorrow? So there's no ability to actually give the background to a conflict, and in not giving the background to a conflict, you're not actually explaining the conflict. The problem is that if one channel was to do that, then they would be always looking over their back to say, well, if we're sort of sticking our neck out and actually trying to explain, trying to give context, will the public switch off? Will the advertisers pull out? Will people move to another channel which is much more interesting and entertainment-y, what have you? So one should flag that there are serious commercial considerations in running a news channel, and that's a big problem. Newsweek or Time always say it. When we put a very hard-hitting cover story that's a war or suffering or what have you, Janine or something, circulation goes down dramatically. If we put a rock star or Michael Jackson or somebody on the cover, it goes up. I noticed the Daily Mirror here in London recently had a front page story on Britain selling arms and airplanes to Israel during the current crisis there. And sadly, you're going to find out next week that circulation of Daily Mirror dropped dramatically when the competitors were selling stories, front page stories about David Beckham or what have you.
We get the kind of
reporting that our society, in a sense, programs us to want. There is a kind of sensationalism that sells. There's no doubt about that. But I'm convinced that newspapers would sell much better in the longer run if they were able to produce what I would then call peace journalism, where the focus would be much more on what's the nature of the conflict and how can it be solved. Now, that doesn't mean that one shouldn't report the violence, but it should not be 98% of the reporting, with practically speaking nothing devoted to solutions at all. And I say that because I think particularly women are much more interested in peace journalism than war journalism. So there is another point here, namely, who is buying the family newspaper? Is it the husband on the way back from job, picking up the afternoon trash, excuse me, to bring it down to the household? Or could it be also an appeal more for the women to buy?
Ultimately, if you're going to bring peace to a region, it's not the international players who you need to convince. It's the local combatants, it's the local civilians, it's the local politicians and activists. We've been too long focusing on what the international community thinks, because we're all too familiar with what CNN and the BBC and what the international states people think. And it's about time that we heard what the local stakeholders think. As September 11th showed us, the danger has been in retreating for various reasons, for reasons of economies or what have you, in actually closing down bureaus and retreating back to London or New York or Paris or Tokyo or Geneva. The intelligence that media, world media, actually generates was not as good. And the level of understanding between different cultures has been pretty poor. So the best way of moving forward from September 11th is actually to say, well, let's use and listen more to local voices, because actually local voices are telling us right from the horse's mouth what local societies are doing, thinking and wishing for.
I still basically believe that people have that capacity to go through all these messages, filter them out.
Professor Sees Hamelink.
And I think we can make an enormous difference together, because in the end, if citizens simply say, take the case of the news. Most of the news programs around the world are just like with most newspapers. It's a commercial proposition. Now, you can talk until the cows come home about how dangerous it is that this is all controlled by people like Rupert Murdoch and Berlusconi and so on and so forth. But that's only true to some extent. The news flows are controlled by the millions of people who buy the newspapers that Mr. Murdoch produces. I mean, if these millions wouldn't like his lousy newspaper so much, he would have to make a different newspaper, and he would. I mean, I remember from a conversation I had many, many years ago with Ted Turner about CNN, that he was very clear on that. He seems to think that since millions of people around the world like CNN so much as the most reliable news source in all these international conflicts, he says, why would I change that? Because of some free-floating sociologist who thinks it's all wrong. No, but if millions of people around the world say we want to have a different type of CNN, that's maybe less American, that's maybe less biased, and so on, then he says, of course, we would have to do it. It's a bit like the good old story in Alice in Wonderland, when one of the figures during a tea party says, but if you like what you get what you like. That's what the media barons say. People like it, apparently. There's very little protest, so if they like what they get, then they get what they like.
Been listening to The Cutting Room, part two of the Sound Fountain series War of Words, produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
Thanks go to peace activist Johan Galtung, international communications professor Sees Hamelink, American media analyst Steve Rendall, author and journalist Mark Hertzgard, and Alan Davis of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
This has been a special holiday edition of Pacifica's Peace Watch. Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. I'm Verna Avery Brown, wishing you a peaceful holiday season.